You know this scene, at least I do. It's been a long day at work. You're late to pick up your kids, and you have exactly 1 hour to make dinner before your family starts a revolution. You need help getting something delicious on the table in short order. New York Times food columnist and food writer Mark Bittman is here to help. His latest cookbook is called How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark Bittman joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
So you've got several books in the How to Cook Everything series. These are bold claims you make. Everything? Really? Everything?
Well, the everything part is, it's the marketers. What can I say? And, you know, How to Cook Everything has always been simple, and it's always been basic, and I like to think it's always been smart, but it wasn't necessarily fast, and that's what people really want. So the goal is that you walk in the kitchen, you open the page to the recipe you want, assuming you have the ingredients, you just start. You turn on the oven, you put a pan on the stove, you start some water boiling, whatever it is. You don't do this outmoded thing that the French call mise en place, this outmoded system of pulling out all your ingredients at once and preparing them and then starting to cook.
These aren't just recipes. You're giving step-by-step instructions. While you're making this, you should prep this.
Exactly. And it's timed so that each step has a preparation angle, a preparation portion, and a cooking portion. But they're timed so that each one segues perfectly naturally into the other.
So I tried my hand at a couple of these recipes.
I'm really glad to hear that.
I made the stir-fried curried chickpeas with potatoes and carrots.
Nice recipe.
It was delicious. And the fastest chicken parm. So I wanted to talk about both of these. I did the chickpeas with potatoes and carrots, honestly, because I happen to have a can of coconut milk way back.
As good a reason as any.
And I needed a reason to use it. And I have to say it was good. It was pretty fast. I'm not sure that can of coconut milk wasn't expired, but you can't help me with that.
You can't lay that on me, no.
But I have to say the chicken parm was not so fast for me.
How long did it take you?
Well, it took me about 45 minutes, but I think that's because the chicken breasts that I used may not have been thin enough.
You cut them in half?
No, I just pounded them to make them thinner.
Well, you have to read the instructions. Oh. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You can't say
it took
longer than I...
So there's no room for improvisation.
Well, let me walk you through the recipe, and we won't criticize your fact that you've ignored the recipe entirely.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think this is my favorite recipe in the book, and it should be 30 minutes. You turn the broiler on. You slice the chicken breasts in half horizontally so they will cook faster, and then you pound them a little bit on top of that.
Yeah.
So they should be half an inch thick at the most at that point.
Yeah.
And then you put the chicken cutlets on this already heated baking sheet and top with these tomatoes that you sliced when you were slicing the chicken breasts. And you just broil on one side, and that should take only 10 minutes or less. And then while that's happening, you grate cheese, mozzarella, and Parmesan, and you get some basil ready, and you make a mix of breadcrumbs and the cheeses. And when the chicken's done, you put all that stuff on top and put it back in the broiler. I've made this 3 or 4 times, and I think it's just an incredible recipe. And it's not only faster than making a tomato sauce and baking the chicken and coating it in breadcrumbs and all of that. I think it's better. It's really got a wonderful freshness to it.
I'll just make sure to read the directions next time.
Thank you.
What's your go-to meal when you come home late and harried and maybe you have great ingredients in your cupboard, but maybe you don't?
Well, if it's late and I'm harried, chances are I don't have great ingredients. I mean, I strongly believe that you have to have a well-stocked pantry and you have to have some stuff in your refrigerator. But if you get home late and harried, chances are you don't. You haven't had time to shop for the freshest stuff that you might have. So I do a lot of pasta. I do a lot of eggs. There's a great recipe in here for scrambled eggs with broccoli that's become a staple for a lot of people. It's just kind of got that right comfort foodie feeling and takes 15 minutes. I mean, it's really good. But I do a lot of pasta when it's late at night.
But the key is to not be afraid. Even I can do this.
That is the key. And to read the instructions.
Yeah. Mark Bittman, he writes about food for the New York Times. He is the author of the new book, How to Cook Everything Fast. Thanks so much for talking with us, Mark.
We have a follow-up this morning on a story from inside the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Secret recordings by a former employee showed how the Fed oversaw Goldman Sachs. We heard some of those tapes on Morning Edition Friday.
In the tapes, bank examiners consider what to do about a major Goldman transaction.
We're looking at a transaction that's legal but shady,
the examiner says. In the end, examiners seem to do very little about it.
ProPublica reported the existence of the recordings along with the public radio program This American Life. And now numerous lawmakers, largely Democrats, are calling for hearings.
One of them is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who once oversaw the federal bank bailout and has now made bank regulation a signature issue.
Ultimately, this report tells us exactly what we already know, that the relationship between regulators and the financial institutions they oversee is too cozy to provide the kind of tough oversight that's really needed.
How is it too cozy? Because, of course, we hear the regulators on these tapes saying there's a reason that we're trying to have good relationships with banks like Goldman Sachs. We want to know what's going on. We want to get information.
Oh, golly. So, look, for me, there were two things that jumped out. The first was just a basic lack of truthful reporting. Supervisors are actually telling examiners not to report accurately the damning things they'd heard from bank executives during meetings. I mean, wow, if there's not even an accurate record of what's going on, then the regulators can't hope to do their jobs. And the second thing, look at how the Fed emphasized talk instead of action. You know, the regulators seem to think that it was a victory just to raise an issue. And that's the kind of approach that allowed banks to take on massive risks before the financial crisis. Does anyone believe that Goldman Sachs is going to give up a deal that would yield millions of dollars because someone fussed at them behind closed doors?
The regulators described this particular deal that was reported on in great detail on the tapes as a transaction that was legal but shady. It did seem to be within the rules. Does that suggest a problem with regulators or the rules?
For me, it starts as a problem with the regulators. And let me describe it this way. The cultural problem isn't just some secondary concern. It's the whole ball game. We can keep making the rules tougher and tougher, but it won't make an ounce of difference if the regulators won't enforce the rules that are there. If the regulators back down or back off whenever the banks tell them to, then it's the banks and not the regulators who are running the show.
Now, you mentioned a cultural problem, Senator Warren. Of course, way back in 2009, there was a report commissioned by the Fed that identified this cultural problem, a reluctance to speak up and a suggestion of a too close relationship with the banks. But what can you really do about that, given that you need to have regulators who perhaps have experience in the financial industry and are going to get to know the financial industry and the people in it really well?
Well, you know, the first thing we can do is expose it. I mean, that's where this really starts. That's the first step. And that's why it is I want to see oversight hearings. I want to get a complete picture of what's happened here. But we need to move on this and move quickly because the big banks are just getting bigger and they're taking on new kinds of risks. We need regulators who understand that they work for the American people, not for the big banks.
I should mention that these allegations have been around for a while. Carmen Segarra's story has been known for a while. What is new here is the tapes. Was there something just from listening to the tapes that you learned that you did not know before?
You know, there is something about listening to those tapes. There's no more he said, she said, one person describes it this way and another says no. It's that you really do, for a moment, get to be the fly on the wall that watches all of it. And there it is, to be exposed to everyone. The cozy relationship, the fact that the Fed is more concerned about its relationship with a too-big-to-fail bank than it is with protecting the American public.
I suppose if a Goldman official were sitting here, they might point out Goldman was complying with the law, at least according to some of the regulators, and the problem was whether they were doing something that was around the edges of the law, so to speak.
Well, you know, but this is part partly the role of a regulator. A regulator doesn't say to a big financial institution, hey, step right up here, get your toes on the line. And so long as you can make a legal argument that you have not crossed the line, then, hey, we're all cool here. That's not the way regulation of large financial institutions is supposed to work. They're supposed to be using judgment. The point of these tapes is that the regulators are backing off long before anyone's in court making a legal argument about whether or not they came right up to the line or they crossed it.
Do you think that regulators in a situation like that could say, listen, this may be legal, but I don't like it, don't do it?
You know, I think what regulators can do is they can remind these large financial institutions that there's a lot of room in there for the large financial institutions to get themselves into trouble and to get the entire economy into trouble. I mean, look, that's what happened in 2008. The regulators had the tools to say to the big financial institutions, hey, guys, you got to back off. You're putting the whole system at risk when you do this. And yet, the regulators didn't do that. They were willfully blind to what went on. And what we're seeing here is that same kind of cozy relationship as the big financial institutions continue to run their operations, taking on more risk, doing what they want to do, and brushing their regulators aside.
Senator Warren, this is something that you're clearly passionate about, but it's a complicated issue, bank regulation. What would have to happen for it to be a major campaign issue this fall or in 2016?
I think it already is a campaign issue. The way I see this, for everybody who's running right now in 2014, there's a fundamental question of whose side you stand on. You know, the game out there is rigged, and people across this country really get it. And the Goldman Sachs tapes just show it one more time. Little banks have to follow the rules. Regular families have to follow the rules. But big financial institutions, somehow they can manage just to push their regulators aside and go forward. There's a fundamental question about who this country works for. It can't just work for those who already have lots of money and lots of power. We've got to have a country that works for everybody else.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Big corporations spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to motivate employees. But low morale, or let's just say it, burnout, is not an easy problem to address. Some companies are trying novel fixes to address the issue. And as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, they say improving morale can pay off.
A few years ago, burnout was a problem at Aptify, a Virginia software company. Projects demanded long hours, which affected motivation and morale. It's a medium-sized firm with 200 workers. But at the time, things seemed overly corporate and cumbersome.
We began looking at things like our policies and procedures manual, which essentially we felt was the culmination of all the bad things that have happened.
Brian Kelly is Aptify's vice president of marketing. He says ultimately the company scrapped its time card system, too. They told employees, you can take as many paid days off as you want. Kelly says initially several employees greeted this with skepticism, expressing concerns like,
okay, great. Essentially what I'm seeing is unlimited time off means I get no time off.
That didn't happen, nor did the opposite. No one abused the policy. A handful of employees took mini sabbaticals or around-the-world treks, things that might have required them to quit in the past. But most take the same number of days off as before and space them more evenly throughout the year. Plus, Kelly says, employees seem happier. Aptify is an exception. On the whole, companies are cutting back on leave. According to the Society for Human Resource Management, firms today offer fewer personal days and family leave than several years ago. Flexibility benefits are also holding steady or declining. Yet Bruce Elliott, the Society's manager for compensation and benefits, says,
the vast majority of employers do get the fact that there is burnout.
The problem is fixes can be hard to implement. And some practices, like unlimited vacation time, he says, tend to work only in high-performance workplaces where expectations for output and quality are very clear.
If those things are nebulous, this thing is going to crash and burn. It just will not work.
WIST Office Products in Phoenix came up with a different approach. Its 70 employees rotate and switch jobs with other employees. General Manager Ian WIST says it seems to be working. People even pitch in on the least appealing jobs, like restocking shelves overnight.
That graveyard shift is tough. I've worked that shift, and it's not a lot of fun.
WIST says job rotation not only helped when workers got sick, it helped retain employees.
People are generally happier that they have some variety and they don't suffer the burnout that they we've seen in the past.
It requires some coordination, but WIST says the policy benefited the bottom line. Customers were loyal to the sales and delivery people.
We found when we lost those people, we would lose our customers along with them.
Some companies simply forego profit to avoid burnout. Point B Consulting CEO Mike Pongin says, unlike most management consultants, his employees don't travel, and every year they decide how many hours a week they wish to work. Pongin says accommodating that comes with a business downside.
Somewhere between 5 and 7% of the time, we have to turn away work that we otherwise would do. And in those cases, we have to help our client find another solution, which sometimes means introducing a competitor.
But Pongin says he believes his company's flexible schedule attracts better employees and keeps them for longer because they remain happier. Christina Maslach is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, whose 4 decades of research on the subject helped popularize the term burnout. She says it's a loose term that encompasses a combination of work overload, lack of autonomy and reward, and social and moral discord at work. Maslach says most burnout stems from interpersonal strife, but most employers see the solution as time off.
When it's time off, I mean, that might be time away from work, maybe you're addressing issues of exhaustion, but it's not really addressing what may be the problems at work.
If companies really want to know what's causing burnout in their workplace, Maslach says, they shouldn't just mandate more time off. They should assess the core problem, then design solutions to mitigate those issues. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The first person in the U.S. diagnosed with Ebola is now in an isolation unit at a Dallas hospital. The patient has not been identified. Federal health officials say he had traveled to the U.S. from Liberia, where some 1,800 people have already died from the disease. Health officials here say they're confident that this single case won't lead to an outbreak in the U.S. And joining us to talk more is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Hey there, Richard.
Good morning.
So what more can you tell us about this patient?
Well, we know he flew from Liberia to Dallas on September 20th, and he's been staying with relatives there. He was actually quite healthy when he flew. Symptoms appeared on September 24th. Symptoms can be like a sudden headache or fever, nondescript kinds of symptoms. He actually went looking for treatment on September 24th. They went to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, but they didn't diagnose Ebola. They sent him home. He was brought back by ambulance a couple of days later on Sunday, and he's been in the hospital in isolation ever since. The hospital says it was prepared for Ebola, they had an isolation ward, but the man is critically ill right now.
Now, you mentioned that his symptoms appeared later after that flight, but what about the people who are on the same airplane? Are they at risk for contracting Ebola?
They are not, according to health officials. The rule with Ebola, which has been around since 1976, so they understand this virus quite well, is that if you don't have symptoms, you're not at risk for spreading the disease. Dr. Thomas Frieden, who heads the CDC, actually said there is zero risk of transmission on the flight. And on top of that, the man was checked for fever before he got on the flight, so that's further evidence that he wasn't sick while he was flying. There's actually one known instance where an actively ill patient was on a flight. He flew from Liberia to Nigeria, and he was actually seriously ill throughout the multiple legs of that flight, and he never got sick. So there's an indication that even if people are sick, actively sick on a flight, it's not a high risk for spreading the disease.
We mentioned U.S. officials being confident that a single case won't lead to an outbreak in the U.S. What's behind that confidence? What's the plan to prevent an outbreak in the U.S.?
Well, the trick to controlling a disease like this is to identify anyone who's had close contact with him, anyone who was once the man had symptoms, that is. And Dr. Frieden says there were only a handful of people who are at risk, and they will be followed for 21 days to see if they develop any symptoms. 21 days is the maximum incubation period for this disease. And so basically, if we know it doesn't spread easily, it really needs close contact of bodily fluid. So if people who you know may have seen this man or something like that are not at risk. So the trick to controlling the disease is just find the people who had close contact and follow them closely.
You've given us a long list of people who are not at risk. Who is at greatest risk from contracting the disease from this man?
Well, clearly the family he was staying with and the physicians who tended to him when he was ill, medical workers. If they were using correct infection control, like gloves and masks and so on, they're at very low risk for getting the disease. But he came to the hospital once. They didn't understand that he had this very serious disease. They sent him home. So presumably some of those medical workers will be monitored carefully to make sure that they didn't, you know, get in contact with his bodily fluids and so on. It's a very scary disease. We know that because it's so deadly. But it does not spread easily. It doesn't spread through the air or anything. So that's reassuring.
We have heard about other people treated for Ebola in U.S. hospitals. What's different about this case?
Those other cases were diagnosed overseas, and they were brought into this country in special transport planes designed to carry highly infectious patients. They were under isolation all the way. His case is different. He flew commercial, although, as I said, there's the health authorities say there's zero risk of transmission during that flight because he was not showing symptoms. But, you know, he has been in touch or in contact with healthcare workers and his family. So that's a difference that he's there are more people potentially exposed. But the CDC says they expect essentially to be able to put an end to this right here. There will not be an outbreak as a result of this.
That's NPR's Richard Harris. Richard, thank you.
My pleasure.
We're going to hear now about two of the most controversial words in education these days, screen time. One fear about screen time is that it's hurting kids' social skills. On Morning Edition today, we heard about a recent experiment. Researchers found that kids who spent time away from electronic devices got better at reading emotions on people's faces. But for some educators, screen time isn't all bad. Corey Turner of the NPR Ed team has the story of one Los Angeles school that's embracing technology in an effort to protect kids from it.
Yay! Can you say good morning, Ms. Vogelson?
Good morning, Ms. Vogelson.
The hallways are humming with kids at Westside Neighborhood School. It's morning. A gaggle of first graders has wrapped up breakfast and heads to class. WNS is an independent school, pre-K through 8th, tucked into the shadow of a Home Depot in LA's booming Playa Vista neighborhood. It's close enough to the ocean that the air is more salt than smog.
So our third grade is on this side, and here is the lab right here.
I get the grand two-story tour from Judith Joy. She's executive assistant to the head of school, and she walks me to the technology lab.
So you can see we have a room full of computers, and then on the side we have our nice little robots that the kids get to play with and tinker around with. And you should see the stuff they create. It is really awesome.
We'll come back to the lab in a minute, but first, the man behind Westside's pretty radical technology policy, head of school Brad Zacuto. When it comes to talking about screen time and kids' access to handheld devices, he likes to use an old-fashioned analogy.
It's like putting a child behind a wheel of a car. There's a lot of power there.
Zacuto says, think about how dangerous it was back when cars first hit the road. No traffic lights or street signs. Well, that's where we are now, he says, with kids and all this technology at their fingertips.
It's here to stay. But at some point, you have to teach kids how to drive a car responsibly.
How does he do that? First, no smartphones till 6th grade. Even then, kids can bring them to school, but they have to check them at the front desk. Second, by engaging and educating parents. WNS makes them sign a commitment to limit screen time at home and to keep kids off of social media, again, till 6th grade. Also, at school, no technology at all until 2nd grade.
We choose to have our youngest children engaged in digging in dirt and building things and using their hands.
Not just hands, but eyeballs and brains, too, interacting with other kids face to face, because they need lots of early practice relating, reading emotion, and responding to it. Screen time just gets in the way. In second grade, Zacuto says, kids start using classroom laptops. They get some basic lessons in typing and word processing, and their first taste of internet research, which makes this a good time to go back to that technology lab.
Hi, how's it going? Don Fitzroy, nice to meet you.
Don Fitzroy is EdTech coordinator at Westside Neighborhood School. By fourth grade, just about every student has sat through a class like this.
So we're going to be talking about digital citizenship today. And I wanted to begin by giving you guys an opportunity to watch a short video about something called a digital footprint.
The idea is to get kids to think hard about the dangers of social media before they have Twitter handles or Facebook pages. After the video, Fitzroy sits in a half circle with a handful of students and talks through a cautionary tale.
They say something online, and then suddenly they say, I'm going to delete this. I changed my mind. I didn't mean to say that. And it's out there.
13-year-old Tom Zimmerman gets it.
One example, this one kid who was like in this room and he had like this fake lightsaber and he was acting really crazy and it looked really stupid. And it was funny, but I'm sure that kid won't want it in the future. But so many people have taken that video and put it on their channels that there's no way of getting rid of it.
That video of one kid in a heated lightsaber battle with himself is pretty amazing. He's swinging a golf ball retriever, and he's just so intense about it. High-stepping, swatting the floor, losing his balance. It's been watched millions of times. But the so-called Star Wars kid, now in his 20s, says he was bullied because of it and had to leave school, which gives principals like Brad Zacuto not one, but two big reasons to worry about screen time. Because of what's not happening, important face-to-face time, and because of what is happening, kids putting themselves out there in embarrassing and potentially dangerous ways. Which raises the question, what is good screen time?
It's all about how things are used and how much they're used and what they're used for.
Patricia Greenfield co-authored that study we mentioned in the intro. She's a professor of psychology at UCLA and has been writing about screen time for 30 years. She says, for example, asking kids to write an essay using the computer can be a good thing. It can help with spelling and grammar, and they can use the internet for research. Here's the key.
You're not substituting screen time for interaction time. You're substituting alone time with the screen for alone time with your paper and pen.
Greenfield describes a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Is this screen time coming at the expense of face-to-face time? And what unique value does the technology add? At Westside Neighborhood School, when kids use tech, often they're still working collaboratively and doing things they couldn't do without it. Again, head of school, Brad Zacuto.
We have a design class where they imagine a product, they design it, and we have a 3D printer where they then create it. I mean, there's amazing things going on that's preparing them for the world they're going into.
Another simpler example, math homework. Kids in the same class but at different skill levels can do work that matches their ability. And starting in sixth grade, Zacuto students can do it all on school-issued tablets. Some teachers even put short lectures online for students to watch at home.
It sort of flips the content. I'd rather be spending my time in school with the teacher, with the kids, doing interactive collaborative, using what we've learned.
Which, oddly enough, means using screens to increase the time kids at WNS spend working face-to-face. It's a delicate dance, preparing kids for both the digital age and the social world. But it's important not to sacrifice one for the other, says Yelda Uhls, who co-authored that screen time study with Patricia Greenfield. When kids hit middle school, she says, the balance of power in their lives tilts away from their parents toward friends.
One of the reasons it's so miserable is because we're trying to learn our place in the social world outside of our safe little haven at home.
The more practice kids get, reading emotion in voices and posture, the better they'll be able to navigate the turmoil of early adolescence. And that kind of learning just won't fit in the palm of your hand. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.
We report next on a hot new social network called Elo. It's been a week or so since that site went viral. A whole week. That is a long time in cyberspace. So now the online world is watching like a soap opera to see whether Elo lives or dies. Nishat Kerwa talked with some of Elo's new users, as well as others who are already abandoning the social network.
Vermont's known for its green pastures, farmsteads, and roads free of billboards. The founders of the new social network, Elo, live in the state, and they want to bring Vermont-like serenity to the internet.
We set out to prove that a social network will survive and thrive that doesn't have a business model of selling ads to its users.
That's Elo CEO and co-founder Paul Budnitz. He says Elo's creators launched the site for their circle of friends. They wanted a clean online space to exchange large images and long-form text. Budnitz says the site has been growing steadily for about a year, but that changed last week. News stories about a group of disenchanted Facebook users mentioned Elo as an alternative and set off a stampede of interest.
We're getting about 40,000 sign-ups and requests an hour, so it's a lot.
You need an invite from a friend to use Elo, and that amps up the allure. Many Elo users I talk to, like 24-year-old Charity Walden, say they joined simply out of curiosity.
I use Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, Snapchat, and that might be it.
And you needed another one.
Yes, of course. I need, you know, to fill up my full 24-hour day.
The spike of interest in a new social network also points to intensifying concerns over issues like data mining, online bullying, and the protection of privacy. Users can't make their Elo accounts private, but the founders say that's coming soon. And Elo's stated mission is to be profitable without selling user data. That claim attracts scrutiny. Once it was revealed that Elo received venture capital money in January, critics went to town. Aral Balkan is a privacy advocate who's building an independent operating system. He says he doesn't want to support a VC-backed social network that will face pressure to balloon in size and value.
If you take venture capital, at the very beginning, when you went to investors to ask for money, you had to present your exit plan because that's when the investors make their money back. Even before you've built the thing, you're selling the people that you hope to get to use it.
After just a few days, Elo user Jimmy Chan is also losing interest in the site, but for a different reason.
Some of my friends are simply jumping in to say, you're all still here, as if it was Monday morning and people are still in the living room from a Sunday night party.
Chan says Elo probably won't be fun for him until it picks up traction with more friends and offers different features. The site's being tweaked and reworked in full view of a rapt online audience. The founders are responding to complaints and requests as the site takes shape. Co-founder Paul Budnitz has a relatively chill attitude about the critiques.
I'm in Vermont. I'm not in Silicon Valley, you know?
He's confident that Elo can make money through a freemium model. Users would pay for extra features like the ability to access multiple accounts with a single login. Budnitz maintains that the founders don't feel undue pressure to compromise their ideals. He says they're content to stay small and modestly profitable, in a Vermont kind of way. For NPR News, I'm Nishat Kerwa.
She's a reporter for TurnstileNews.com, a tech and digital culture site from Youth Radio.